like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. My guest today is Dr. Brian Hare, Associate Professor of Evolutionary Anthropology at Duke University and regarded as an international expert on dog cognition. He's also the author, co-author, with Vanessa Woods, of The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. We'll speak with Dr. Hare presently. Also, later in the show, we'll have a brief chat with David Kirby, investigative journalist and author, most recently of Death at SeaWorld, Shamu and the Dark Side of Killer Whales in Captivity, now out in paperback. Kirby's acclaimed book is the literary counterpart to the also acclaimed new documentary, Blackfish. Also, Name That Animal Tune will be giving away a copy of Death at SeaWorld. So stay tuned for that. It's coming up at the end of the show. Right now, though, let's talk dogs with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663. Let's welcome Dr. Brian Hare to Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Hare.
Hey, Duncan. Great to be with y'all.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning on Talking Animals. And so obviously we're going to spend a lot of our conversation discussing dog cognition and dognition specifically, I guess. But I'd like to start by addressing a bit of your cognition, if I could. So you've clearly had an enormous interest in how dogs think, sort of a precocious interest, really, in some ways, given that it started pretty young. Why? Why do you think that you had that interest, and you obviously had it sort of very early in your formative years?
Well, I think there are personal and scientific reasons for that. One is, my best friend growing up was a dog, and so if you are a dog lover, you're obviously fascinated by what's going on inside their heads. So that's the first reason was my best friend growing up was a Labrador Retriever named Oreo, and we went everywhere and did everything together, and so I just wanted to know, just like anybody else, more about what was going on inside his head. And when I got to college, it ended up that there's a whole field of research where people try to understand animal psychology, and it ended up nobody was really interested in studying dogs, and so through sort of happenstance, that ended up being a direction that we went, and we discovered, that dogs are really quite remarkable when it comes to their social problem solving. And that led to lots of people getting excited to study dog psychology.
Absolutely. And we're definitely going to delve right into that in just a sec. But yeah, I mean, to me, it's just interesting still because a boy and his dog is a classic theme. But that usually refers to that sort of potent love and companionship shared by a kid and his dog and playing for hours on end and barking on adventures and sort of Lassie and Timmy played out over and over. But it does not usually necessarily suggest the basis for a scientific study or an academic career, but it just sounded like there was a confluence of factors in your case that caused it to do so.
Yeah, so I still had Oreo. I should say my parents still had Oreo. I actually stayed in my hometown to go to college. I grew up in Atlanta, and I went to Emory University, and Oreo was still alive when I was in college. And so basically I was studying chimpanzees and human infants. And we had a hypothesis at the time that really there was something special about human infants that develops early that doesn't really develop in chimpanzees, and that's the ability to read gestures. And that understanding human gestures, so pointing to somebody or looking in the direction that they look, that was really crucial for human infants to develop language and all sorts of cultural skills, basically to be able to learn from others in a way that other animals can't do. We didn't see chimpanzees doing that, and having grown up with Oreo, though, it made me wonder, well, wait a second, I think my dog does all this stuff that we see human infants doing, and that's fascinating. Why would it be that chimpanzees don't use gestures the way that humans do, but, potentially dogs do? And so then we went, and literally the first study we did And we just play fun games, problem-solving games.
Yeah.
And literally, the first thing we did is I went home to my garage, my parents' garage in Atlanta, and we played the same games that we were playing with human infants and chimpanzees. We played them with my pet dog that I grew up with, Oreo.
Yeah. And really, yeah, I mean, just maybe elaborate on this, since it's kind of pivotal to our conversation in some ways, and certainly kind of pivotal to the Brian Hare saga. Maybe you could discuss in a little more detail the pointing test.
Well, it's really simple, and the idea is that you hide food or something that an animal is interested in, and you hide it somewhere where they know that it's going to be in one of two places, but they don't know which place it is. So it's like the good old shell game. But unlike the shell game where somebody hides something and switches things around and tries to confuse you, actually you just hide something in one of two places, and then you just point or you look to where you've hidden it. So the idea is that, you know, if you're a chimpanzee or a child or a dog, well, it's actually a quite easy test because you don't know where it is, but they're telling you. They're communicating. They're trying to help you find it.
Yeah.
And the big surprise was that as smart as chimpanzees are, they can do so many remarkable things, they really flunk this test. And so, it became apparent that this was measuring something really important. And then dogs are really good at this.
And, you know, I have to say that one of the sort of, unspoken themes of the book is that over and over, maybe obviously less so now in the wake of your work and others too, but the dogs for a long time in this realm really kind of got short shrift, right? You always hear about chimps and how smart they are and all the kinds of things that establish that and other animals too. But one of the things that I think early on in the book even that I found really surprising is this thing where only two research projects to evaluate dog intelligence happened between 1950 and 1995?
Yeah, dogs were seen as wholly unremarkable.
Yeah.
And if you were going to find intelligence on Earth outside of our own species, that, you know, the place to look would be in our close relatives, the primates, or in some other charismatic animals, like cetaceans, dolphins.
Yeah.
So all the research effort, and there's not, obviously, this is not a hugely funded area, and so all of the research effort with the resources available went into studying those organisms. Nobody thought that dogs were going to have anything particularly interesting to tell us. And so what happened was, of course, right underneath our, literally at our feet,
yeah,
was this incredibly remarkable animal that's going to tell us so much about ourselves and about how animals think. And so that was what happened about 15 years ago, is because we went and did this study with Oreo, and we realized that, my goodness, dogs are doing something that we thought was so crucial to human development. Lots of people were surprised by that in the scientific community, and so science woke up and realized, duh, dogs are totally remarkable, and now, today, they've become the most important species you could study, and everybody's really excited about learning more about how they think, and there have been really fun and cool discoveries, and that's what the genius of dogs is all about, is explaining those discoveries to people, and, you know, what science has found out that probably many people may have already felt like they knew.
Yeah.
I think in many cases there are going to be some things that will surprise you.
Absolutely. Well, that's the thing. I mean, one of the things that you sort of just described is that the book also makes clear is that this was like a scientific snobbery busting that, like, hey, you know, why are we looking all these other places when the dogs are fascinating and again, as the pointing test and other things illustrate, can actually do things and think about things in ways that, smart as they are, the chimps cannot. So let's give the dogs their due a little bit.
Right, and I think part of the problem is it's the conception of intelligence in our culture is that, you know, there's sort of, you either have more or less intelligence. It's like a cup that's either half full or half empty. And when you think about different species, there's sort of there's a ladder, and at the bottom are sponges, and, you know, at the very top are humans, and somewhere in the between are all the rest of creation.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's actually not, if you take an evolutionary perspective, if you take a cognitive perspective and you base your approach on science, you really quickly realize that's a ridiculous way to think about it. It's obvious that each you know, organism has its own way to survive and be successful.
Yeah.
And, you know, just the case in point, you know, I don't think I'm very good at echolocation. I don't think I would be a very good dolphin, for instance, because I wouldn't be able to deal with 3D space.
Right.
And so there are lots of different types of intelligence that animals have that, in many cases, humans don't even have that, you know, if you think of intelligence in this other arcane way, you would miss out on. So dogs have their own unique intelligence that has allowed them to travel across the world with us and be really the most successful mammal on the planet, except for ourselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no way that you can't have anything but tremendous respect for that accomplishment.
For sure. And sort of begrudgingly, it seems like scientists and others are finally giving up that respect. So,
Well, and I think part of the issue was, you know, it was also a bias in how people thought about what domestication is. There was a strong sense within science that basically, as an animal becomes domesticated, well, they don't need to defend themselves anymore. They don't have to find food. They just sit around and let humans do everything. But actually, in the case of dogs in particular, that's just not true. It ended up, you know, part of what allows dogs to be such great companions is the fact that they are actively able to use us and manipulate us in ways that other animals can't.
Oh, my God. Yeah, anyone who's lived with a dog knows that they're extremely gifted in those ways. Yeah, but, well, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Brian Hare, professor at Duke and co-author with Vanessa Woods of The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. If you'd like to ask Dr. Hare a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So, Doctor, I really liked reading The Genius of Dogs in a bunch of ways, and one of the most important ways is that it made a number of research studies and academic findings over you know, a fairly large span of time really accessible to the lay reader, maybe even the lunkhead reader, just speaking for myself. I mean, it was not like there wasn't anything really opaque, even though some things were really some fairly sophisticated concepts in a lot of the studies and findings, and it also made me think, if I'm ever in the neighborhood at Duke, I'd like to audit your class, maybe. But
you're welcome.
All right, cool.
Hopefully, we're going to do an online course soon.
So oh, great, great, great. So yeah, so you know, anyways, the book has so much ground to cover. So there's no way to sort of wrap our arms around all of it in the allotted time this morning. But so I may just kind of skip around a bit, if that's okay. And one place to start is guilt. And sort of getting the word out about your appearance, one of the Facebook posts that I did elicited this comment from a friend. It says, "Yep, my dog knows exactly what he's doing when he steals bread from the uppermost counter storage area and then looks so guilty when I get home." Then I replied, "Dog guilt, real or imagined, is one of the things we may well discuss on Wednesday." And then this person said, "Oh, it's real, believe me. As I'm walking in the door, he's hiding under the kitchen table, hanging his head in shame, dead giveaway, laugh out loud, too funny. For all that, he gets a stern finger wagging and, quote-unquote, bad boy." So I immediately thought of the point you make in the book that 75% of owners believe their dogs feel guilty for disobeying or something like that. But maybe you could talk a little bit about that, the Alexandra Horowitz experiments that sort
of... There's a nice study that basically... Alexander Horowitz did a beautiful job testing the idea, are people able to recognize guilt in dogs? And the punchline is no. And how she was able to test that is she had dogs either do something that was mischievous or not, i.e. disobey, but when a person walked in, they didn't know whether the dog had done something mischievous or not, i.e. should they feel guilty or should they not.
Yeah.
And regardless of what the dog had actually done, people thought the dog was guilty if the dog showed behaviors of submission. So if the dog does the hiding on the table or sort of crouches, people said, oh, they're totally guilty. But dogs in the experiment were doing that regardless of whether they'd done anything wrong or not. And so actually we're not very good at recognizing when dogs have done something wrong using their behavior, because it just ends up that's what dogs do when you enter a room in many cases. So it certainly looks like guilt, but it doesn't mean that that's what the dog is indicating. Now, it doesn't mean that humans aren't good at telling lots of other things. I mean, one of the things we talked about in the book was really fun is that humans, in many cases, are really good at understanding or hearing when dogs are barking what different barks mean, whether a bark is made in distress or not, and even in some cases, whether the bark they hear is their own dog. So that's one of the fun things about the new science of the dog mind, is it really tells you the limits of what we're able to recognize in our dogs, and where we really are quite good at understanding our dogs. And I think it allows us to sort of enrich our relationship.
So, because I was just going to say, that last point you made is sort of under the heading of, since this show is called Talking Animals, I thought it was, very important to get at least touch on the idea of can dogs talk, which you've just sort of alluded to, in the sense that they do alter their voices for the purpose of projecting different meanings. And most of us human types are fairly good at identifying what those different barks and growls and different things mean. So.
Absolutely, and I think that leads to the next point, which is just to talk about dognition for a second.
Yeah.
What the book is all about is all of dogs and what science has discovered about all dogs. And it's a fun review of the scientific literature, and I hope it's very accessible, and that's thanks to my wife, not to anything of my abilities to write. But dognition is all about your dog. And because we've learned so much in the last 15 years about dog psychology, enough to fill a book about it, we now have been able to create an online resource for everybody to go and test or play these games, participate in activities that their dog will enjoy, that they will enjoy, that allows you to understand your dog and how your dog plays these problem-solving games and what it means about your dog. Because dognition, what's so fun and what it celebrates is the individual dog. Just like people, we all know that, anybody who's owned multiple dogs knows that they're so different from one another. And what dognition helps you do is understand exactly what that is. So, for instance, with my own dog, I obviously played the games since we developed it.
Yeah.
And what I discovered is, contrary to my belief, my dog actually is quite empathic. Before I played the games, I predicted that he would not be particularly empathic in the games that we have that help you measure this.
Hmm.
I also thought that he would be an amazing communicator, meaning he would be really good using my gestures. And actually, he's quite average. And what Dognition does is it gives you instructions on how to play games like this to measure your dog's empathy, communication, their memory, their inferential skills, and even how cunning they are. And then it compares your dog and how it performs on these games to all other dogs in our database. We have thousands of dogs that have played. And it's not about, is your dog smart or not? It's what are the skills your dog rely on to be such a wonderful companion? And in the case of my dog, I learned something. I didn't know that he was so empathic relative to other dogs. I thought that he wasn't at all, actually. So it's helped me understand him better and know the individual I actually live with. I think people are going to really have a lot of fun. Not everybody can come to the Duke Kennel Cognition Center or the other cognition centers all over the country now. But what you can do is go online to dognition.com. It's now there is a free start. You can play two of the games for free. And obviously, if you want to sign up, you can get a full report. It has 15 pages of details about how your dog compares to other dogs, to wolves, to chimpanzees, and I think it'll be really exciting, and everybody who's done it has learned a lot about their dogs, and I think people are enjoying it.
Yeah, and what's really also kind of cool about it, that it works both ways, that as you pointed out, owners, including yourself, who's pretty steeped in the dog world, were surprised to find some things about your dog through the Dognition process, but that also, if I'm not mistaken, Dr. Hare, that as people do this and sign up, that of course expands your collection of information, your database, I guess, for lack of a better term, about dogs in a significant way.
Well, right, it helps all of us, because the goal is that as people learn about their own dog, you're contributing data to really the largest database on dogs in existence. And what we're going to do, what we are doing with that information, is we are, analyzing it. We're testing ideas that people have about how dogs think, and then we're publicly sharing what we're finding.
Yeah.
So everybody gets to learn about all dogs and the new things that we can discover with this data that has helped you learn about your dog. And I think we're all going to benefit from it. And the fun thing is, you're really contributing to real science.
Yeah.
And we're going to be able to answer questions that we just have not been able to answer before. Things like what makes breeds different from one another. We've already discovered a really fun difference between purebred dogs and mixed-bred dogs. We're going to be able to look at sex differences. We'll look at the development of these cognitive skills. And all of this has application to helping shelter dogs get adopted quicker, to helping train service dogs so we can get more service dogs out to people in need. So you can feel really good about participating and learning about your own dog.
For sure. Well, so we got some callers here, but before we get to at least one of those, not surprisingly, perhaps the guilt conversation has triggered at least a small flood of email, including one that says, "My dog acts entirely, all caps, different when I come home after her doing something wrong, consistently." And then another one says, "But I want Lucy," presumably her dog, "to feel guilty when garbage is strewn across the house." So that's really more just a quick note there. But interesting, again, how people feel about their dogs and their dogs' abilities or tendencies to feel guilt. And again, how much people may be projecting or determining something that may or may not be what the dog is actually feeling.
Well, this is the moment where you have to be humble as a scientist and say, science is a conversation. And the fact that people feel so strongly about it, maybe there is something there. Alexander Horowitz did one experiment. I think it's a great experiment. It was very well designed, and it was very well carried out.
Yeah.
But it certainly needs to be replicated. And it is totally possible that in another context, in another experimental situation, maybe we do see that people are good at telling which dog is guilty and which dog is not. But I would say, as a scientist, all we can rely on is the peer-reviewed published literature where experimental manipulations have been done, where we can control all types of factors. And the only data we have suggests that people are not very good at this.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to accept that, but if it's true that people can recognize guilt in their dogs, we should be able to do an experiment, and it should be the case that if the dog is mischievous, but you don't know, but the scientist knows, that you can identify that, and if the dog is not mischievous, you can identify that, reliably, and the case is that people don't do that.
Right. Well, of course, this might be an example of something, data that emerges from the dognition juggernaut that suggests a different conclusion at some point. So
absolutely, and I think that's the most important thing for people to understand is that, dognition is a great way to become a citizen scientist. If you have strong opinions about how the dog's mind works, this is your moment to go and participate and contribute to, what we're learning and our knowledge of how dogs think. So it's not that scientists have all the answer, absolutely not. But what we can do is help everybody as a community work together to make, exciting discoveries and share that with everybody so we can all learn more about our best friend.
For sure. Cool. Let's get to at least one of our callers. Hi, you're on Talking Animals, Dr. Brian Hare.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I just wanted to share, I've had two poodles for a long while, and one of them had a seizure disorder. And it took me, the human, a while to catch on that the other dog would give me a warning. His bark was entirely different when I guess there was an aura prior to the seizure. And I would do therapeutic touch for a little bit, and the seizure would be less intense. Sometimes it would just be like a petit mal as opposed to a grand mal seizure. But one of the most important gifts this what gave me, when my dog would have a full-blown seizure, he would often be incontinent, and then he would appear ashamed. He would hang his head. He would, and that was just more painful than anything. And so when Clancy would warn me with that a seizure was coming, and I could somehow or other short circuit it, pun intended, it was a win-win kind of thing. But it was funny that it took me, and I'm in the medical profession, it took me a long while to catch on.
Well, that's really cool. Thanks for your call. Any comment on that, Dr. Hare?
Oh, sure. I mean, what's fun is that there's actually wonderful evidence now, and dogs are being trained to actually detect seizures in people.
Yeah.
And we have a student here locally that was not able to go to school anymore. She was a young girl, and she essentially was having to be homeschooled as a teenager because she was having so many seizures. She was paired with a seizure dog, and this is a dog that basically can, there's actually olfactory information that's released that they can detect, and also your behavior as well. And the dog, when it could detect a seizure in the young girl here locally, the dog could lean on the young lady and would apply pressure, and that would then prevent her from having seizures. She's in school now, and she's doing great. And so it's absolutely the case that dogs can potentially detect seizures in others.
Cool.
So, you know, I think that's one of the fun things is as scientists have woken up and gotten excited in dogs, I think we're going to have, you know, a lot of new information about how dogs solve problems and how they don't solve problems and how we can use that information to help people and help dogs.
Cool. Well, again, this is Talking Animals on Duncan Trust. My guest is Dr. Brian Hare, an expert on dog cognition and co-author of The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. Let's take one more caller. This person's been holding quite some time. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Brian Hare.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, of course.
I was intrigued earlier when you were talking about hand signals and recognizing pointing. Because we have a little Malty Poo that loves to take her toys and whip them around in her mouth until she lets them go and they fly across the room. And then she has to go look for them, and sometimes she can't find them because she, like, whips them behind a table or something. So we kind of point and say, over there, over there. And at first she wouldn't know what we were doing, but eventually, especially if we started walking toward the toy with our fingers pointed, she would recognize that and follow. But she really, if we just sit in one spot, she doesn't really seem to recognize the pointing. So is walking toward it something that might help her recognize that and get familiar with recognizing that hand signal?
Yeah, so absolutely. What we found is that, you know, the more robust, the more obvious that you can make the gesture, you know, the better. And it is indeed the case that smaller dogs sometimes struggle a little bit because of how tall we are, they have to look up farther, and so sometimes they don't see the information as easily.
Right.
And so, but just on the point of, you know, an interesting piece of data is we have done developmental studies on dogs, and dog puppies as young as 6 to 9 weeks old are paying attention to human gestures. So it's not something that they need to learn, but you know, and need a lot of exposure to acquire the ability. But the interesting thing is there is tremendous individual variability, and that's where dognition is really useful, is you can compare your dog and its communicative skills to other dogs. It may be that I'm forgetting what the breed was, your dog may, was it Malty Poo?
Yes,
right?
Malty Poo.
It may be that your dog is one that doesn't really rely on gestures relative to other dogs. And it may be that, you know, vocal commands and other things might be more useful. So that's one of the fun things about dognition. But thanks for sharing the story. That's cool.
Yeah, thanks for your call.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. So, Dr. Hare, one of the things you mentioned earlier, sort of an outline, some of the things that the dognition information will help further sort of illuminate is the differences between breeds. And a bit of a running theme on this show is examining the myths and misconceptions surrounding pit bulls. Obviously, they get a bad rap, and there's all kinds of reasons, media reports, sensational hysteria, discrimination. So I was really delighted to see you deal with this in the book. And as one measure of how sort of complicated this realm can be, can you talk a little bit about the what I'm just calling the dachshund study?
Help me. Which one?
Well, that's the one that I think when you were talking about some of these issues of aggression, there was some study I think you cited where the dog that was kind of deemed to be the most aggressive, I think, with strangers or whatever, was a dachshund? Was the dachshund?
Okay, yeah, of course. So the idea that pit bulls are somehow more aggressive than other breeds, you know, the prediction is if you go to the literature and where people have tracked the number of injuries or the number of attacks, et cetera, that, you know, pit bulls should be number one. And when you go into the literature and you look, it's just not the case. In some studies, it's you know, it'll even be golden retrievers. It could be Labrador retrievers. It can be, you know, in some studies it's the Chow Chow. In some studies it's, you know, Doberman Pinschers. In one study it's even the Dachshund. So it really is the case that there is no consistent dog breed that has been shown to be more aggressive. I think the one thing that the literature screams and is very, very clear about is that the most likely case where a dog, and there are, you know, lots of people bitten by dogs every year. It's a huge problem, obviously.
Sure.
And the place where you can consistently predict that people will be bitten is, and it seems so obvious, but here's where the problem is. A child under the age of 10 left alone with a male dog with no parental supervision. That is where the vast majority of bites occur. And so it's not about pit bulls. It's about a male dog with a boy under the age of 10. And, of course, it's not easy to make a law about that. It's very easy to make a law about a pit bull. And so, I think that if the real goal is to help people deal with, aggression, then you have to have data to understand what the real problem is. And I just don't think that, you know, there's evidence that pit bulls are the issue. I think that, you know, the funny way I try to talk about it is if people who like to have dogs communicate their toughness all of a sudden decided instead of pit bulls to communicate their toughness with Cocker Spaniels, well, I guarantee you that it would be that we'd have breed-specific laws about Cocker Spaniels.
Yeah.
And I think this is more about, a cultural phenomenon than it is anything to do with the genetics of a certain breed.
For sure, because as you've talked about a number of times on this show, any given generation has what is now the pit bull, right? The big bad dog that you always have to be worried about and is always responsible for all the dog bites. But that's shifted, obviously, over those generations. So further suggests that people have sort of become fixated on the pit bull, but there's not necessarily a lot to support that, as you've pointed out.
There's one more fun one on breed differences that I have to share.
Please.
I have to share it because it's come out since the book was published. I don't think we talk about it in the book. But now there are a couple of studies showing that this whole idea that there's some breeds of dogs that are hypoallergenic.
Right.
There's absolutely no support for that. I say that and it's a bummer because I guess there are lots of people who have allergies that wish that they could have a dog. But basically, the studies I've seen, what they do is they actually collect dander. They collect the amount of dust in different houses with different either claim to be hypoallergenic or dogs that are not. And there's absolutely no difference in the amount of dander or dust created. And what people are responding to when they're allergic is a protein in dog saliva. And that then obviously gets on the hair and the dander as they groom themselves and then is spread, throughout the house. So the idea that they're hyperallergenic dogs, it was a brilliant marketing scheme by people breeding dogs, but absolutely no scientific evidence.
Wow. Well, so then that leads me to this question, Dr. Hare, because we have friends like my son's best friend. His mom, very, very allergic. So they got, I forget what the breed is, but it's a hairless breed. I mean, kind of a freakish but cool-looking guy. And so...
The Mexican...
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah. So I guess my question, in light of what you're saying, is then, is there some kind of counterpart almost to the placebo effect that then has allowed them to say, hey, thank God we have Paco here, and I'm not having any kind of allergic reaction, because if I follow what you're saying before, there wouldn't necessarily be any difference if they had a different kind of dog in the house.
Well, based on the best science, and again, I go back to saying science is a conversation, and so, it could be next year there's a study and somebody did another methodology and they found out, wow, there are two breeds that are really, really different.
Yeah.
But at least with the evidence we have now, there's really not a breed that is different.
Wow.
And so even the hairless dog is shedding skin.
Yeah.
And those skin cells are going to have saliva and the protein from the dog's saliva, and that dander is going to go, throughout the house. So if they're not having an allergic reaction, it's just because probably it didn't matter what dog they were going to have, they wouldn't have had that reaction. And there's a lot of variabilities. There's a lot of variables that go into your response to dogs. It can be that you're cleaning the house more because you now have that allergy with your new dog. You're cleaning the house more, or it could be that actually your body has adjusted.
Yeah.
And maybe for 10 years you'll be fine, and then maybe it's a combination of the dog and actually some grass that, you know, has something you're allergic to, and it's those two things together, and that for some reason the grass isn't, you know, setting you off and in combination with the new dog. I mean, it's a very complicated thing, but I can tell you that there's really just no evidence that there's a difference.
Interesting. Well, we're just in our last moment or so here, Dr. Hare, but I don't think we're going to get to all these, unfortunately, but there's a couple more emails. I'm at least going to try to get to one of them. One email that says, can they, meaning dogs, tell how much time has passed, i.e. how long we've been gone from the house?
Oh, that's an interesting one. So I do not know the answer to the question about time. That's actually one of the toughest areas to study in terms of dog psychology. But I can tell you that they do have amazing memory, and that they do, as we suspect, there's evidence that they remember individuals, you know, up to many years. But there's a limitation on that. There's a beautiful study we review in the Genius of Dogs where dogs that were family were reunited years later. There was a mother gave birth, and they were reunited with their puppies 2 to 3 years after they were born and sent to different human families. So the mother recognized its offspring, the offspring recognized its mother, but the siblings didn't recognize each other. And it was only if dog siblings had lived together with other siblings that they could recognize additional siblings they hadn't been raised with. So basically, if you separate a dog from its family, it will not recognize siblings years later.
Wow. Wow. Well, Dr. Hare, I don't know if I'm going to try to shoehorn one in. If I don't know if there's a way to give a fairly brief response to this, but this is one also I think is really interesting that comes up periodically. Do you believe there's any truth to the notion that dogs who are rescued from abuse or hardship feel and show their appreciation to their new caretakers?
Well, you know, anytime I have to answer a question like that, I take my science hat off and I answer as a person, and the answer is yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, me too.
I don't know that there's a good way to measure that.
Right. But anecdotally, it does seem like, you know, people will tell you that over and over and over, that's their experience.
Absolutely. That's one where I don't really care what the science says.
All right, let's forego science for that moment. All right, so Dr. Hare, we have just about reached the end of time. We've been speaking with Dr. Brian Hare, Associate Professor of Evolutionary Anthropology at Duke. His own website is brianhare.net. And then, of course, the Dognition site is Dognition, dognition.com. And the book is The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. Dr. Hare, this has been really fun and fascinating. Thank you so much for making the time to join us on Talking Animals.
Take care.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. All right. In just a few minutes, we'll speak with David Kirby, whose critically lauded book, Death at SeaWorld, Shamu and the Dark Side of Killer Whales in Captivity, was recently issued in paperback. Right now, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. This is Dave Attell with a brief piece called Parrot on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry. I thought I had a parrot on my shoulder. You ever get that? Nothing. I wish I had a parrot. I really do. And I wouldn't teach him dirty words or songs, no. I would teach him phone numbers and addresses and recipes. I'd use him more like a Palm Pilot, you know? Or I'd teach him things that might save my life, you know, like information, like, in case of an earthquake, get in the doorway. No one has freckles on their ass. Use a condom. Thank you, parrot. Here's a grape.
All right. That was Dave Attell with a piece called Parrot, taken from his CD Skanks for the Memories. All right, so let's turn our attention now to orcas. David Kirby's book, Death at SeaWorld, Shamu and the Dark Side of Killer Whales in Captivity, is now out in paperback. So we spoke to David in a full-length interview about the book when it was first out, but let's welcome him back now to Talking Animals. Good morning, David.
Hey, Duncan, I can't believe it's been a whole year.
I know. Boy, a lot has happened in the orca world. I mean, so, you know, the book, as we talked about then, was fantastic and highly acclaimed, and rightly so. So a paperback edition, obviously, was always going to be coming out, I'm sure. But this one seems particularly geared to Blackfish, the documentary sort of on orcas and SeaWorld that came out about a month or so ago, and it's really kicked up quite a bit of attention and acclaim itself. So was the idea to sort of make an actual connection between the paperback release and the film coming out?
Nope. It was just all one big happy coincidence. The film was slated for release in July, and my hardcover came out in July of last year, and typically the paperback comes out 1 year later.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that Gabriella, the director of the movie, was working and doing her research parallel to me at the same time I was doing my research. Our paths crossed. We collaborated and shared information, but they're two separate projects.
Yeah, yeah. But I do see them as sort of, at the moment at least, kind of counterparts.
Well, I think they are. I think they complement each other really well. It's an excellent movie. I like to think that, you know, I'm happy that as a writer I was allowed all that space and page and real estate to include a lot more details and background and maybe some more nuance and the private lives of the trainers that, you know, you don't really see in the movie. And, of course, I included the story of Dr. Naomi Rose, who is, you know, arguably probably one of the most important figures in this whole debate. She's not only an orca scientist, she's been fighting SeaWorld for 20 years or more. So,
yeah.
You know, I think visually and in terms of content, the film is fantastic. I hope if people see it, they will be interested in learning more and might check out the book.
For sure. Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, as we talked about a year or so ago, I mean, the book is meticulously researched. There's all kinds of incredible reporting that's sort of deep and wide, and including with Dr. Rose and others. And again, you know, overlapping some of the thing. Of course, Tillicum, the big, huge bull orca had attacked and killed Don Bronchot, who that's sort of a centerpiece of your book in many respects, but there's a lot more to your book, but certainly more directly a centerpiece to the film. But I guess I'm wondering at this point, between, you know, your great book and the film, what's your sense of the awareness now of the public and about these sorts of issues and what goes on?
Night and day. I mean, when my book came out a year ago, nobody knew anything about any of this.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't before I started, you know, researching it. And now the media is, you know, because of Blackfish, they covered Blackfish, they reviewed Blackfish, and then they started looking into the underlying question of captivity. Is it good or not? Most people in the media conclude, the same as Gabrielle and I did, that it's not. You know, when you examine the evidence fairly, it's very hard to come to another conclusion.
Yeah.
So I think in terms of the government, you know, they just blocked imports of these beluga whales in terms of entertainment. Pixar just announced they're changing the end of their movie so it doesn't have a pro-captivity message. In terms of, well, attendance was way down at SeaWorld in the second quarter. Now, we can't say that was because of Blackfish, but it might be because of a growing understanding that cetacean captivity is... time has come.
Yeah.
It should be phased out. And I also just think that, you know, when I first told people way back, you know, 3 years ago, they said, what's your next book about? And I would say, SeaWorld. And they'd look at me with a puzzled look. I go, you know, Shamu. And they just didn't get it.
I mean,
they just didn't register. Now, you'd say, killer whales, and people know exactly, you know, the story.
Right. So, well,
but it was Don Bronchot that really... sadly, changed everything. I wish things could have changed without somebody dying.
Of course,
before,
but yeah,
people dying, really.
Right. Well, that's the thing, and as you made clear in your book, and as the film makes clear, I mean, part of what was so striking about that was that she was so, you know, experienced and careful and smart and respected. So no matter what SeaWorld kind of spin they would want to offer, couldn't really say it was carelessness or the ponytail story or whatever they might try to say. I mean, she was top notch.
Well, and everything she was doing was perfectly within SeaWorld protocol, and that came out at trial.
Yeah.
When they took Ocean Accord. I'm about to release I think tonight, and hopefully on Anderson Cooper. I'm waiting for confirmation. Two videos showing trainers in the medical pool with Tillicom up close, touching him, petting him, rubbing him, touching his mouth. They're in about maybe 2 feet of water, and it's Tillicom. Now, this was before he killed Don, but he had already killed two other people, and SeaWorld was allowing its trainers to get in the water with him and be, literally hugging him.
Right.
And it's knowing what you know now to see that video is just chilling. And that SeaWorld allowed this to go on and allowed its trainers to get into shallow water with this animal, just like Don Bradshaw did. It's just astonishing.
Well, so David, we're just almost out of time, but a couple quick things. One is, you know, I remember when we spoke a year or so ago, and, you know, in the wake of the OSHA hearings and some other stuff, you didn't seem to think, unfortunately, for those who cares about whales and people and stuff, that it was really, all this was really then going to make much difference to SeaWorld and especially to their bottom line. How do you view it now?
Again, I think things are very different. I think there's a cumulative effect. Things like there was a big story in the New York Times that mentioned the book and the movie.
Right.
And it was really about captivity, and it was excellently written. And, of course, the New York Times sets the agenda often for the rest of the media. So, and there's been other incidents. There was the pilot whale that was stranded at SeaWorld Orlando on the slide-out area.
Yeah.
That video went worldwide. So people are paying attention. They're paying closer attention. The media is watching. The government is watching.
Yeah.
OSHA's not giving up this fight. Of course, neither is SeaWorld. That's going to be a big one. If there's oral arguments in federal appeals court on this case, SeaWorld's attorney is the son of Justice Scalia.
Right. Yeah.
So if that happens in, you know, downtown Washington, D.C., oral arguments, you can bet it will be a media frenzy. So the point being, yes, people are paying much more close attention. I'm sure Naomi Rose would back me up on this. She's been watching this for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Blackfish had a lot to do with it. I'd like to think my book had something to do with it.
Of course, yeah. And like you said, it was cumulative, right? I mean, I think your book really sort of set the context for who knows what Blackfish would have done had there been no book of yours. But I think it was absolutely a continuum that sort of really led to this kind of explosion in a way of a whole different amount of awareness and what people might do about it. Yeah.
I'd also like to credit, I mean, even though it's partly self-credit, TakePart.com. They hired me a year ago to write just a regular, actually it's going to become a regular column called Death at SeaWorld. I'm very excited about that. But I've been covering killer whales, you know, I've probably written 35 stories in the past year about killer whales and their coverage. Not only are they just completely dedicated to this issue, but those stories routinely hit the top of all of their, you know, wildlife stories.
Yeah.
And are often their biggest stories of the week.
Sure. Yeah,
so
it's
people love orcas.
Right, and it's really now got people's attention. One thing you made a past reference to Pixar, but just so to complete that thought, it's actually Finding Nemo, specifically the sequel that has been changed, you know, in the wake of Blackfish, which, I mean, on a cultural level, I think really does speak to what we're talking about as far as the awareness level and some of the changes being made.
And for an indie documentary to impact a major studio like that, you know, really remarkable.
Right. Well, cool, David. So one more time, the book now out on paperback is Death at SeaWorld, Shamu and the Dark Side of Killer Whales in Captivity, and available pretty much anywhere you can get your books. You can get that one and keep an eye out for David's columns. So are you still doing Huffington Post, or did the Take Part thing kind of supersede that now?
I still do Huffington Post every
yeah.
so often, but
okay.
Take Part is great exposure.
Yeah.
Great site.
Great.
I also just want to mention the man who shot the video of the pilot whale is from Tampa, Carlo De Leonibus, and that incident turned him and his daughter against captivity. His daughter now wants to be a marine biologist. She did want to be a dolphin trainer at SeaWorld. So Tampa played a big role.
Well, good. We'll take our credit where we can. Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, you know, coincidentally, the movie Blackfish opens this Friday in Tampa. So get into that in a bit
and
more.
And coincidentally, it's the Tampa office of OSHA that conducted the inspection.
Wow. Okay.
Yes, said the lead inspector, Laura Padgett, lives in Tampa. So.
Okay. I don't think we can make any more connections without starting a fresh page. But David, thanks again for joining us today on Talking Animals. One more time, the book is Death at SeaWorld, Shamu and the Dark Side of Killer Whales in Captivity. Thanks again, David. Keep up the great work.
Thanks, Duncan.
All right, man. All right, I'm Duncan Strauss. Towards the end of the show, which we're a mere moment away from probably, we will play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a copy, a paperback copy of Death at SeaWorld. So let's do a quick abbreviated edition of Animal News and Announcements. Again, Blackfish opens Friday at the Tampa Theater. Screening there through August 29th, tampatheater.org for more information there. One thing, too, that was announced, there is going to be this great bull run, like the running of the bulls set for the Everglades Ranch in Dade City. The date for that at the moment is February 1st, the fourth of nine such events being scheduled around the country, starting later this month, in fact, in Petersburg, Virginia. So there's a Facebook page called Halt the Great Bull Run. And anyway, we'll track that and maybe have some interviews on that if that continues on its track. Last week's show featuring Cindy and George Marks is now posted on Talking Animals. And those are the folks from the Bat Conservancy, Florida Bat Conservancy. And on a related note, there was a story that Janelle Irwin here at WMNF did on the Temple Terrace residents sort of having this controversy over a bat tower there, so you can find that on WMNF.org. I think that's probably all we have time for today, so let's do a Name That Animal tune, and this is a giveaway. You don't need to be a member of WMNF to win. There'll be a prize, again, a copy of Death at SeaWorld to the first person who calls in 813-239-9663 and identifies this animal tune on Talking Animals.
She's fashionably lean, and she's fashionably lame. She'll never.
All right, we're going to probably have to take those guesses off the hair. We have reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. We'll be back next Wednesday with another one. I hope you'll join me then. Also, visit talkinganimals.net. Links to the Facebook page, Twitter feed, and more. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Well, actually, let's see if, since we're not going to play our last animal tune after all, let's take them. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
Walking the dog,
is that what you said?
Yes, sir.
Oh, shoot, I'm afraid that's not it.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune? There you go. What is your first name, sir?
Danny.
All right, I'm going to come and get your information. We'll send you off a copy of David Kirby's book, Death at SeaWorld. Thanks for listening. Congratulations.
All right.
Okay, folks, we do have a winner. All right, so that's it for this edition of Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, WeakyWatchy, and beyond. Thanks for listening. Speak with you next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.